Turn in your Bible to Genesis 42. Genesis 42. If you're new with us this morning, you find us in the middle of a long journey through the book of Genesis. We're about a year and a half into Genesis, and we are in the middle of the Joseph story. It's just been a fascinating time together as we've looked at God's providence in using Joseph and working in his life. And so I just continue to be amazed, and it seems like week after week we come back to the same place as we marvel at God's providence. But that's okay, because I don't know about you, but I need almost a weekly, if not daily, reminder of the fact that God is in absolute control of my life and that the details matter to Him. You know, one of the things that makes a story great is character development. And William can back me up on this because he's a film expert. But we like movies where a character, when we meet them, they are, you know, maybe unimpressive, or they have some major flaw or something like that. But through the course of events, they change. Life happens, and at the end of the story, there's something admirable about them or some quality that is endearing. Well, when we come to the story of Joseph, we see character development on a massive scale, specifically this morning as we'll begin to look at the development of his brothers. These men who sinfully sold him into slavery. And if you haven't been here with us, let me just bring us up to speed. We watched as Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, as I mentioned. He goes down, he's bought by a man named Potiphar, serves in his house, actually becomes the head of the household. Life seems to be looking up for him until he's falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and put in prison for a crime he did not commit. He spends several years in prison. And then last time we began to see that God gave Joseph the supernatural ability to interpret dreams, and he interprets the dreams of two political prisoners in the prison where he's kept. And then finally, through that, he ends up interpreting a dream for Pharaoh himself. And last time we saw that in a moment's time, Joseph was taken from the lowest of society to the second most powerful person in all of Egypt. And we left him last time as ruling Egypt. This prophecy that a famine was coming, there was going to be 7 years of plenty, and Joseph had the idea of gathering in extra food during that time, kind of a tax on the people's harvest, and that way during the 7 years of famine they would have plenty of food to survive. So that's where we left him. We're going to look at the text together really in two sections. We'll look at the narrative as a whole and then our response to the narrative, but as usual there'll be several scenes here are several sub-points that we'll walk through. We're going to begin in chapter 41 at the end because we left off at verse 49. So we're going to quickly look at verses 50 to 57, and then we'll dive into chapter 42. So look at chapter 41, verse 50, and this is point one, or sub-point one, a divine blessing. A divine blessing. Read with me verses 50 to 57. Now before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble in all my father's household. He named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. When the 7 years of plenty which had been in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, then there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, you shall do. When the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt, the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the earth. I think it's important to see here that the blessings for Joseph continue. We left last time, obviously he had the blessing of being exalted to a new position, but here God blesses him with children, with two sons. And he names them based upon his circumstance. The first son's name means causing to forget. And Joseph says, because God has caused me to forget my father's household. What he means is, God has exalted me, he's given me the blessing of this child, and it's caused me to forget the pain that was associated with my family. He names his second son a name that means he has caused me to bear fruit, giving praise to God's glory because God has blessed him again, even in the land of his affliction. And we see that that Joseph is proven to be faithful here in verses 53 to 57. This was scene 2, point B, a providential famine. A providential famine. We see that the 7 years of plenty have stopped, and I'm sure they went by just like that. And now there is this severe famine that is causing great distress in all the land of Egypt. And it really proves that Joseph was, in fact, a man who could hear from God, who knew the true God, because his prophecy comes to pass. In verse 57, we see that this famine was so severe. Look at the last few words in verse 57. The famine was severe in all the earth. It wasn't just Egypt that was experiencing the famine, but it was the entirety of the region. This is a massive problem. And of course, we're a little bit out of touch when it comes to just how severe a famine could be, because by God's blessing, we now trade with different countries. And so if it's bad here, we can get food from somewhere else. But here it was all regional. You grew your own food, or the people around you grew the food. And if no one had food, there was no other place to turn. And so it leaves the whole earth in a predicament. And God uses Joseph to provide grain. Pharaoh tells all of Egypt to go to Joseph, and he begins to give out the grain that he stored up. We didn't get to make much of this point, but I just want to mention Joseph did something very wise in verse 48. If you look back at verse 48, it said he gathered all the food of the 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt, and he placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food from its own surrounding fields. So instead of, because Egypt is a large place, instead of sort of gathering all of the food into one central location where people would have to travel a long way to get the food, he put the food scattered around Egypt so that you could go just to your local city, a central place in your local town, and have food. And so that's what begins to happen. Joseph begins to give out the food to the people. Now that brings us to chapter 42 and our next scene, an innocent visit. An innocent visit. Let's read verses 1 to 5 in chapter 42. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" He said, "Behold, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place, so that we may live and not die." Then 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "I'm afraid that harm may befall him." So the sons of Israel came to buy grain from those who were coming, among those who were coming, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now it's been quite a while since we've talked about Jacob. Remember, Jacob is Joseph's father, also named Israel, the man through whom the nation of Israel comes. And now we've zoomed in on Joseph for several weeks now, and the text backs up, and we're going to see that this famine intersects not just Joseph, but the covenant family. And it's kind of a funny verse here in verse 1. He looks at his sons and he says, "Why are you staring at one another?" But basically what he says is, there's a famine and you guys are sort of twiddling your thumbs. We know that there's grain in Egypt. Go buy us some. And so he sends his sons to go buy grain, but he doesn't send all of his sons, does he? Who is the one that he keeps behind? Benjamin. Now, why is that significant? It's the other son of Rachel. It's Joseph's younger brother. Remember, Rachel only had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. As far as Jacob knows, Benjamin's the only one left because he thinks Joseph's been killed. And he says specifically, he's not sending Benjamin because I'm afraid that harm may befall him. Well, is he not afraid that harm may befall the rest of his sons? What do we see here? We see the favoritism of Jacob again, and this is going to sort of set the stage for the rest of the narrative. Jacob has taken the favoritism he had for Joseph that caused so much strife in the family, and now it's been given to the younger son, Benjamin. And so he has a special love and a special protection for his son, Benjamin. And what we're going to see over the next several chapters is we're going to find out, are these 10 brothers who so viciously sold their own brother into slavery, cared nothing for him, are these 10 brothers the same men that they were 20 years ago? About 20 years have passed. Remember, it was we said that there was about 13 years that Joseph had been in Egypt, And now the 7 years of plenty have happened. If we add that together, 20 years. So 20-something years have passed since Joseph has seen his brothers. Are these the same men that they were before? That brings us to our next scene, a painful reunion. A painful reunion. Verses 6 to 13. Now before I don't want to just blow through the text. We have a lot to read, and so we're going to go quickly. But don't let that cause you to sort of halfway go through this. Put yourself here, okay? Put the context here. Joseph has not seen these men in 20 years, and the last time he saw them, they were selling him into slavery, and he was pleading with them not to do it, and they didn't listen. Keep that in mind. Look at verse 6. Now Joseph was the ruler over the land, and he was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, "Where have you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." But Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams which he had had about them. And he said to them, "You were spies. You have come to look at the undefended parts of our land." Then they said to him, "No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." Yet he said to them, "No, but you have come to look at the undefended parts of our land." But they said, "Your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no longer alive." Now let's think about this for a moment. Pretend you're Joseph. And you're there, you're going about your normal duties, you're overseeing this massive operation of giving out food. And here come this band of men, and as they come closer, something is familiar about them to you. And suddenly you realize, those are my brothers. The same guys that I haven't seen in 20 years. And he recognizes them, and what do they do when they come before Joseph? Did you catch that? What do they do? They bowed down. Now, why is that significant? Joseph's dreams. Remember, it's so interesting because now Joseph, the one who has been given the ability to interpret others' dreams, sees the fulfillment of his own dreams. Now he gets it. You can almost see the light bulbs going off. All those years of wondering, what in the world were those dreams about, God? What in the world were you doing when you gave me those dreams? My life has been nothing like those dreams. In a moment of time, as his brothers come and bow before him, it clicks. And the text even tells us that Joseph remembered the dreams. Verse 9, Joseph remembered the dreams which he had had about them. Now, we have to address the fact that his brothers don't recognize him. Some people find a problem with that. There's really no problem. One, they haven't seen him in 20 years and he was a teenager. So you, while you look the same, you definitely change in your appearance. Also, he's probably dressed like an Egyptian. And he's speaking to them, we find out, through a translator. So, and also, they have no idea what happened to him. As far as they know, when they sold him into slavery, he's probably dead by now. So he's the last person that they're expecting to meet, certainly not as a ruler of the land. So it's not at all hard to believe that they didn't immediately recognize their brother Joseph. And Joseph sort of plays off of this, and he begins to question them harshly. And we have to kind of figure out what he's doing here, because he's obviously accusing them of being spies when he knows that they're not spies. He knows who they are. So what is he doing? And there are a few different ideas about this, really the whole Joseph narrative and his interactions with his brothers. But my opinion, as we look at the text, I think we find that Joseph is actually creating a series of tests for his brothers to test their character. He's asking the question, are these the same men in their character that 20 years ago sold me into slavery? And he's going to kind of concoct a plan, a master plan, to find out, are these guys different than they were before? And so he begins to question them, and what he's doing is he's finding out information. He wants to know, is my dad still alive? Where's my younger brother? Did you kill him too, or did you sell him into slavery? Where's Benjamin? Why is he not here? But he can't ask that way. So as he begins to accuse them, they start to defend themselves by giving personal information about who they are. Notice they say, at the very end of what we read, verse 13, they said, we're 12 brothers. Basically, we're not spies. But that would be dumb. If we wanted to become spies, we wouldn't bring a family. We would bring different people. We're just a family coming to buy food. And he says, we're the sons of one man, and we live in Canaan. And he explains, we're 12 brothers, but the reason there's only 10 of us is the youngest one stayed with our father. So now he knows Benjamin's still alive. And they say the one is no longer alive. Now think about how that would have felt as Joseph to hear your brothers say that. I mean, just the emotion of this scene just can't get any higher. As Joseph is there and he's hearing, he's seeing his brothers and he's hearing them talk about him as being dead. I just don't think we can comprehend what this must have been like. Now, there's one other thing I want to point out. It's interesting. Did you catch how they described themselves to Joseph when they first started to defend themselves? They said, no, we're not spies. We're what kind of men? Honest men. We're honest men. Joseph knows these are not honest men. Okay, they're the furthest thing from honest men that you can get. He knows their deepest, darkest sin and secret. And so there's just irony dripping from the text as they say, no, we're not spies. We're good guys. We're honest guys. When he knows, in fact, they're not. That brings us to another scene, a calculated test. A calculated test, beginning in verse 14. Let's read together. Joseph said to them, It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you will be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you that he may get your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. But if not, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Now Joseph said to them on the third day, Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison. But as for the rest of you, go, carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words may be verified and you will not die. And they did so. Now here's the test, and it's more than a test. I think it's really a master plan of Joseph to do several things, as we will see. But he tells these men, he takes them and he puts them in prison for 3 days. Now, some have accused Joseph of sort of a petty plan of vengeance towards his brothers and says, hey, you put me here, I'm going to show you what it's like, and I'm going to throw you in prison. But I find that hard to believe because Joseph is the ruler of the land. If he wanted to punish his brothers, he could have done it however he wanted to. He could have said, execute them on the spot, they're spies, I don't need any evidence. And I don't really think the point was fully to punish his brothers as to give them time. He wants to put them in sort of a pressure cooker. Because all of us know when we are put under pressure, we find out really what our character is. He wants to pressure his brothers to put them in an uncomfortable situation. And through that, he's going to begin to ascertain the quality of their character. So he puts them all in prison together. He tells them first that he's only going to let one of them go home and keep them all in prison and make until they can bring Benjamin back to verify their truthfulness. But after 3 days, He graciously sort of backs off of that, and he's going to allow all of them to return except for one and keep one in prison. As I thought about what Joseph's doing, I think it's somewhat like the reality TV show Undercover Boss. Anybody ever seen that? You know the premise of the show. Some of you may like it, you may not, but that makes the point. These high-ranking officials, they disguise themselves and they go into their own company as a low-level employee, as a trainee, with the intention of finding out what goes on behind the scenes. And if you've worked in a restaurant or something like that, you know a lot goes on behind the scenes that the owners would not particularly approve of or be happy about. And so they go in and they find out, you know, this guy's a nice guy, this lady's not, whatever. But the reason that they disguise themselves is obvious. They know if I go looking like myself, I'm not going to get a true picture. They're going to all be on their best behavior. If you work at a restaurant, you know when like the health people are coming or whatever, everyone's like, hey, they're coming today, like make sure you do everything right. So we understand that happens. And so Joseph is going to test them so that in a way that they won't, he'll be able to find out their true character. If he had revealed himself right away, he doesn't have any danger of them harming him. Again, he's way more powerful than they are, but he would never get an accurate picture. They would be on their best behavior, kissing up to their brother because they'd be afraid. And so he chooses to wait and to put them through these circumstances to see if they are genuinely repentant for their actions. Now look at his graciousness to them. He allows the men to return. He's going to send 9 of the 10 back. And notice what he says. He says, excuse me. If you look back at verse 16, he says, send, and I guess I go down further. 18. Now Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison. But as for the rest of you, go, and here's what he tells them to do, carry grain for the famine of your households. Joseph realizes, if I only send one of them, there's no way they can carry enough grain to support the family back home. And so graciously, he only keeps one brother in prison as insurance, otherwise they would, may never return with Benjamin at all. But he sends enough of them that they can adequately provide for the family back home. It's a gracious response from Joseph. Now notice his brother's reaction. This is very interesting. This is the next scene, a guilty conscience. A guilty conscience. Verse 21. Then they said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore this distress has come upon us. Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. They did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. He turned away from them and wept. But when he returned to them and spoke to them, he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Now this, to me, is a heartbreaking scene. And it's interesting because as these men are sort of pressurized, what comes to mind for them as to why this is happening? It's obvious after 20 years, the very first reason they come up with still is, this is punishment. God's punishing us for what we did to our brother. We treated him unfairly, and now we're being treated unfairly and accused unjustly. And this is our fault for what we did to our brother. Reuben, of course, the oldest brother, chimes in with a timely, I told you so. I was there. I told you guys not to do this. And here we are now. We're paying for it. If you just listened to me, we would have been fine. Now, imagine yourself. Obviously, they're speaking in Hebrew, which would have been the language that that Joseph knew from birth, but obviously he speaks Egyptian now. And so he's been speaking through this interpreter, but he understands fully what they're saying. And to hear them talk about what they did to him, and the description, as they say, you know, we heard the distress of his soul, and he was pleading with us, and we didn't listen. Just picture the pictures that would have been washing back over Joseph's mind as he hears his brothers discuss what they've done to him. And he gets this new piece of information that he didn't know, that Reuben was trying to stand up for him. And it was too much. It was too much for him to bear. And he runs out of the room, excuses himself so that he can find a private place to cry. Then he returns and he takes one of the brothers, the second oldest, Simeon, and puts him in prison. There's a lot of ink spilled as to why he doesn't take Reuben, the oldest brother, but possibly it's because he now knows that Reuben fought for him, and so he takes the next oldest brother, Simeon, and puts him in prison. Just the whole story is just packed full of emotion. That brings us to our next scene, a frightful discovery. A frightful discovery. Verse 25. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. And thus it was done for them. So they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed from there. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money, and behold, it was in the mouth of his sack. Then he said to his brothers, my money's been returned, and behold, it's even in my sack. And their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? A frightful discovery. It begins in verse 25 with really a gracious response of Joseph. Not only does he give them grain, he tells his servants, fill their bags with grain, give them provisions for their journey, and give them their money back. We're going to give it to them for free. And some said he was just playing with them. I don't think he was just playing with them. I think he was actually giving them their money back. He was not going to charge them for the food. Now, it becomes, obviously, a test for them. And they stop somewhere along the way, on the way home. You can see this happening, and they're taking a break, and one of the brothers goes to feed his animal, and so he gets some of the grain out, And when he looks, his money sack is there, and it's not just there. It's not as if he had misplaced it in some of his possessions. It's in the mouth of his sack that was given back to him, or given to him from the Egyptians. And he knows he didn't do it. And he says, guys, look at this. Look, I don't know what to do with this. And notice what their response is in verse 28. At the very end, what is this that who? That God has done to us. They still see this. They say, God is getting back at us. This is the worst thing that could have happened. They're trying to prove to the Egyptians, hey, we're just good guys. We're not spies. We have the best of intentions here. And what happens now? How are we going to explain away this? It looks like we sold the grain from Egypt. No one's going to believe me that I just found it in my sack. That's a really likely story. Now they're terrified. What are we going to do? This makes us look awful. And they realize the only answer must be that God is certainly against us and he's repaying us for our sin against Joseph. That brings us to the next scene, a father's reaction. A father's reaction. Now, I'm going to, for the sake of time, we're going to skip reading part of this because they just tell Jacob what happened. So let's skip down to verse 35. So they explained to him that Joseph told them, called them spies and said, you've got to come back and bring Benjamin with you. Then verse 35, it came about as they were emptying their sacks, now all of them are emptying their grain sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were dismayed. Their father Jacob said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin? All these things are against me. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, you may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you. But Jacob said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you're taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Obviously, a couple of things. They tell their story, and then they go to unpack, and not only was the money in one of the sacks, but all of them have their money back. Now we have a huge problem. It looks like all of us just had a big plan to rip off the Egyptians, and we stole from them. There's no way we can get out of this. And on top of that, Dad says, no way are you taking Benjamin there, especially not now. Not now. I mean, one, Joseph's gone, and he sort of blames them. There's not any indication that he knows what they've done to Joseph, but he's just angry, and he says, you took Joseph from me. Somehow it was your fault. You should have looked out for him, and you let him get eaten by a wild animal. Now you took Simeon from me. There's no way I'm sending Benjamin down with you guys to Egypt. Now we see his favoritism again, because notice how he describes Benjamin. It says in verse 38, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. Now, obviously he's talking about he's the only son of Rachel left. But the way he says it, it makes it sound like he's the only son I have left. Ironically, he's talking to nine of his other sons, which would have been offensive. Benjamin's not the only one he has left. He has the rest of his sons. But we see his favoritism. And this is perfect because it's really, not only are these guys being squeezed by their circumstances, but they now have the temptation to respond in anger to their father's favoritism as they had with Joseph. So what are they going to do? What's going to be their response? Reuben intercedes. Now, big brother steps in trying to find a way to convince his dad to let him take Benjamin down because it's the only way they're going to survive. They've got to have food. And he has a very foolish option. He offers, basically, he says, if I don't bring him back safe, you can kill two of my sons, which is a terrible idea, and I don't know why he would even think that Jacob would want to do that. But he was trying to make his point that I'll put it on me, I will take care of Benjamin, let's just go back so we can get Simeon. Remember, Simeon is his brother, his full-blood brother, so he's thinking, I want my brother back, just put him in my care, I'll take care of him. By the way, Benjamin's not like five here, he's probably 21 or 22. So it'd be like most of you, right around that age. That brings us to chapter 43. A fearful return. A fearful return. This is verses 1 to 15. So let's read all the verses together. Now the famine was severe in the land. So it came about, when they had finished eating the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back, buy us a little food." Judah spoke to him, however, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we'll go down and buy food. But if you don't send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, 'You will not see my face unless your brother is with you.'" Then Israel said, "Why do you treat me so badly by telling the man whether you still had another brother?" And they said, "The man questioned particularly about us and our relatives, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' So we answered his questions. Could we possibly know that he would say, 'Bring your brother down?'" Judah said to his father Israel, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever. For if we had not delayed, surely by now we could have returned twice." Then their father Israel said to them, "If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry down the man to the man as a present, a little balm and a little honey, aromatic gum and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. Take double the money in your hand and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother also and arise, return to the man. And may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man, so that he will release to you your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the men took this present, and they took double the money in their hand and Benjamin. Then they arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. So here comes the inevitable scene that was coming. The food runs out. They can stall no longer. The family's going to starve. They have to go back and get more food, and Egypt is the only option by God's divine providence. We see now that the famine was much more than just God using Joseph to provide for the nations. It was a means by which he brought back together and reunited the covenant family. And that's really the theme this morning anyway, is that God providentially uses a famine to reunite the covenant family. Now, they have to go back, and so Jacob pretends to forget the whole main issue and the elephant in the room and just says, "Hey, go get us some more grain." And Judah steps up this time because Reuben's attempts failed. And Judah says, "Well, we'll go, but you got to send Benjamin with us. Remember, the guy told us we won't even be able to come before his presence, let alone get grain, if we don't have our youngest brother with us." And so they go through this argument, and Jacob says, "Why did you even tell him you had another brother in the first place?" He says, "We didn't know. He was asking us specific questions. How are we supposed to know that he was going to say, 'Bring Benjamin with us'?" Now, it's interesting that Judah is intervening here, and that Judah even offers to be sort of responsible. He says, "Hold me responsible forever for Benjamin if I don't bring him back safe." Now, why is it interesting that Judah, of all the brothers, is putting his neck on the line? Someone other than Cameron. I let you answer all the time. I might have to let you answer. Somebody other than Cameron want to answer that? Why is it interesting that Judah, of all the brothers... Yes. Yeah, he was the main guy. Remember, they have Joseph in this pit and they're eating a meal, okay, which was crazy. And then Judah says, "Hey, let's don't kill him. We can make some money off of this deal. Let's sell him into slavery. We don't profit anything if we just kill him. We can make some money." That was Judah's idea. This cold-hearted, callous plan originated with Judah. And yet Judah is here now sticking out his neck for Benjamin, the now favored son, saying, "Look, Dad, just put it on me. I'll take him. I'll take care of him. If something happens to him, I'll bear the blame for the rest of my life before you." So Jacob realizes there really is no other way. And so he says, "If you're going to go, then at least take a present with him." And remember, back in verse 11, he lists this long list of things that were specific to the region that would have been a thoughtful gift to someone of Joseph's status. And he says, "And also take double money, give them back the money that we found in the sacks, and take enough money to buy more grain, and take Benjamin with you." And finally, gratefully, we see a right response of Jacob in the end, because he throws himself on God's providence. Look at verse 14. At the last part of verse 14, he says, "And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." Essentially, and before that, he says, may you find, by God's grace, may you find favor with this man. He says, if it's in the Lord's hands, It's in God's sovereignty. If I lose my son, I lose him. So now the scene is set for another visit, another face-to-face encounter with Joseph. And that brings us to another scene, an unexpected invitation. An unexpected invitation. Verses 16 to 23. Let's read together. Verse 16. When Joseph saw Benjamin with him, he said to his house steward, "Bring the men into the house and slay an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon." So the man did as Joseph said and brought the men to Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house, and they said, "It's because of the money that was returned in our sacks the first time that we're being brought in, that he may seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for slaves with our donkeys." So they came near to Joseph's house steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house and said, "Oh, my Lord, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. And it came about when we came to the lodging place that we opened our sacks, and behold, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full. So we've brought it back in our hand. So we've also brought down other money in our hand to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks." He said, "Be at ease. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. When they show back up, I'm sure that they're just expecting to make an exchange. They'll say, "Look, here, we weren't lying. Here's our younger brother. We'll get our brother back. We'll buy grain. We'll give him the money back. We'll go home." But when they show up, the first thing that happens is they receive an invitation not to just meet with Joseph in private, but to eat with him at his house. And so they come into this, they don't know Joseph's house, but this, in their mind, a rich ruler's house. You can imagine it probably was extravagant. And they're there and they're wondering, what in the world are we doing here? I mean, what possibly could this be about? And so they land on one option. The only thing that makes sense is that he's bringing us in here to arrest us because he thinks we stole money. But we didn't steal it. So they come up with an idea. They go to the head servant of Joseph's house and they explain their case. And they say, "Listen, we really did come to buy food last time. But when we got down the road, we found the money in our sacks and we don't know how it got there." What's more interesting is how the servant responds. Did you catch the response of the servant? Verse 23. This is Joseph's head servant. He says, "Be at ease, do not be afraid." And here's why. "Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." And they bring back in Simeon. Now, this must have been puzzling to them. How does this man know about our God specifically? And it sounds almost as if he has some respect for our God. What's this coming from? Now, obviously, we have to read a little bit into this because we don't know exactly. But at the very minimum, maybe Joseph told him to respond this way. Or perhaps even better, he's observed now this man Joseph. And he's seen the character of Joseph. And he's seen the obvious relationship he has with God to predict this whole famine. And perhaps he now has become a worshiper of the one true God. But that he adds the phrase, not just "your God," which would have been common, but "and the God of your father." It's this specificity of this phrase, of this God that he's referring to. He says, "I had your money. So God just put some treasure in your sacks. Don't worry about it." Now they're really thinking. Well, they're kind of relieved, but they're thinking, "Wow, this is so weird. How did this happen?" And they bring in their brother, and so now they're at ease. That brings us to another scene, a tearful reunion. A tearful reunion, verse 24. Then the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys fodder. So they prepared the present for Joseph's coming at noon, for they had heard that they were to eat a meal there. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present which was in their hand and bowed down to the ground before him. Then he asked them about their welfare and said, "Is your old father well, of whom you spoke? Is he alive?" They said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed down in homage. As he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's sons, he said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "May God be gracious to you, my son." Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother, and he sought a place to weep. And he entered his chamber and wept there. Joseph comes home for lunch break. Everything's ready. The men have prepared their gift, and they bring in their present. And again, what do we see them doing? bowing down to Joseph. This time all the brothers are present because Benjamin is there. And he begins to ask them again specific questions, which must have been puzzling to them, again about their father. Is he still alive? Is he well? And of course, we know what's going on. He's inquiring about his dad. He wants to know if he's still alive. Certainly, he hopes to meet him again. And then he lays his eyes on his youngest brother. Now, when he left, if we have a timeline here, Benjamin was probably not, maybe not even 2 years old when Joseph was sold into slavery. So he hasn't seen his brother in 20 years, and his brother was just a little baby when he left. And now here's his brother Benjamin, 21 or 22. He sees him a full-grown man, and he pronounces a blessing upon him from God. May God bless you, be gracious to you. And you can imagine the emotion as Joseph sees his brother, and he can't stand it. It must have seemed odd and strange to the brothers, but he immediately removes himself, and he goes into the other room. And he begins to weep. And he must have been weeping really hard because he had to wash his face. He had to cover up that he'd been crying. And he washes his face, as we'll find out, to come back out. But we just see this, the amazing amount of emotion. And think about just the thoughts. We can put ourselves there. The joy of seeing his brother. The sadness for the lost time. Maybe a little bit of the anger, the hurt again, of just what his brothers had done to cause this. Just a massive amount of it was joyful crying at the same time a sadness. And that brings us to the final scene for this morning, a gracious feast. A gracious feast. Verse 31. Then he washed his face and came out, and he controlled himself and said, "Serve the meal." So they served him by himself and then by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is loathsome to the Egyptians. Now they were seated before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth, and the men looked at one another in astonishment. He took portions to them from his own table, but Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. So they feasted and drank freely with him. Now in this meal we see a gracious response of Joseph to provide such a lavish meal for his brothers, but also this is part of his plan. Notice, first of all, a peculiar seating arrangement. How did he seat the brothers? Did you catch that? You can just call it out. How did he seat the brothers? Say it again. Yeah, oldest to youngest, in order. Now, there's 11 of them. And for you math wizards, you might find it interesting. There are 39,917,000 different orders in which 11 individuals can be seated. So this was not just... just kind of happened. How odd. That's odd. We're all sitting in order. They're looking down. Maybe this is some other, a lot of weird stuff's been happening. Maybe this is another God thing. But obviously this cannot just happen by chance. How did this guy know? Maybe he talks to God, and maybe God revealed to him the order. I don't know, but this is strange. And not only that, but he serves them. So you picture this. The Egyptians had a prejudice against Hebrews, so they're sitting by themselves. Joseph, because of his position, he's sitting by himself. And the brothers are seated in their own table. And all the food is at Joseph's table, excuse me, as the host. And they're bringing the portions from his table. It's more of a symbol of him sharing food with the brothers. But he gives Benjamin five times. Five times the amount as the other brothers. Again. There's two reasons. One, I think he genuinely loves his younger brother. But also, it puts pressure again, and it puts the finger on the issue that was the issue between he and his brothers, this favoritism. How are they going to respond when the youngest one of all of them gets five times the amount of food? But it says that they enjoyed themselves. It says they feasted and drank freely with him. There's no sign of contention among them. There's no arguing. There's no more than just a notice of the fact that Benjamin is honored in this way. Now, this sets us up. I know it's kind of hard to stop in the middle because there's a lot of good things coming. But this sets us up for next time where the reveal happens and restoration happens. But we're going to leave it here. Leave Joseph here with kind of this emotional time. And let's take some time and respond to this text together. And I'd like your feedback a little bit here. Let's talk through this. Just a couple of questions. One, what do we learn about God in this text? in this story? What do we see? What aspects of his character do we see? Yeah, his ability to change the heart. Absolutely. That becomes even more apparent as we move ahead. What else? Yeah, his sovereignty over the details of life. That's absolutely apparent. Anything else? Any other? Yeah, it wasn't a quick thing, was it? Wouldn't it be nice if Joseph only spent 3 nights in jail like his brothers, but it wasn't that way. What else? Anybody else? Yeah.
His heart for evangelism, the steward speaks of John and God as his father, so obviously he was aware of Joseph's.
Yeah. Yeah, I think absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Anybody else have one? You know, there's so much about God jammed into this passage, and I think if you take it home, in fact, I'd encourage you to take it home and just kind of wring it out more and more in your mind and think through what else do we see here, because God's on display. But you hit on the big ones. I mean, obviously providence, as we've talked about week in and week out, that God is sovereign over everything. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I think we all need a daily, if not weekly, reminder of that, because it's easy to walk out of here and remember that in these moments. And then as soon as you leave and go to lunch, the pressures of life come back and the reality of your situation or the situations to come back. And it's easy to begin to be fearful again and to wonder how does God plan to use this? And we have to keep in mind that sometimes it takes a long time. We're not promised a good ending always from a human perspective. We see a good ending here, but we're not promised that. But even in the times where there's a good ending, it doesn't take away the fact that there are real emotional hurts and pain. There's nothing going to restore Joseph's hurt. He restored that relationship, but what was done was done. We also see God's kindness. He's providing for people. He provides food for all the nations. To point to this man, Joseph, because Joseph's God is the one true God. And it glorifies his name amongst the nations. It's a reminder, too, this morning. Perhaps you're not a believer, and you come and you're in a hard spot, and God has graciously brought you to the end of yourself through your circumstances. And He is reminding you here in this text that He's the only answer. There are no works you can do. There is no way that you can make yourself right with God. He's brought you to the end of yourself so that you might see your powerlessness, the fact that you need a Savior in Jesus Christ. And so respond appropriately, turn to Him, call out to Him, the faithful, sovereign God. But secondly, what do we learn from Joseph? And for the sake of time, I want you to take that home and think about what we learned from Joseph, but I'm just going to give you a couple of things. There are many. And obviously, when I say we learned them from Joseph, these are a testimony to God's work in Joseph. They're not his own character qualities by themselves. But as Noah mentioned, forgiveness. We see, and we'll see it on a grander scale as we go through, where these are just the glimpses of forgiveness. But even in his testing of his brothers, he's kind to them. He's gracious. I also find that I didn't have time to go into it, but one thing that's interesting to me about the Joseph narrative is when he rises to power, there's no mention ever of Potiphar's wife. Don't you think, on a human perspective, the first thing you would do when you rise to power is to punish the people that falsely accused you and put you through everything that you did? And she's never mentioned. Think about that for a little bit. Then his brothers come. He treats them with kindness. Yes, he's putting them through a trial, a test, but that will soon come to a close. And we see forgiveness. And we see later in Genesis 50, I don't want to steal my own thunder, but I'm going to, the heart and the reason for his forgiveness is his trust in God. He says, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. I can forgive because I see God's hand in this. And secondly, we learn from Joseph wisdom and reconciliation. Wisdom and reconciliation. Here's what I mean. I don't think this is the main point of this text by any stretch, but I do think it's a truth that we can take. And it's the reality that forgiveness does not mean that we just immediately throw ourselves back into a situation to where we can be trampled and harmed. When a person or a group of people are obviously bent on our destruction and our hurt, forgiveness does not mean that we go and just allow them to trample us. And while I don't think we take from this that we should put people through tests to find out if they're really repentant or not. I don't think that's the application, but I do think the application is that there's nothing wrong with being cautious about re-engaging and taking time and re-engaging in a relationship to where a person has intently set out to harm you and to trample you. We're called to forgive and called to reconcile this as much as it depends on us, but that doesn't mean that we have to continually throw ourselves to the wolves, so to speak. There's so much we could take from this if we had the time, and I hope that you'll think through it. But overarching, God is good. He's in control. And He calls us to be good and forgive others, not because of our own strength, but because of what He's done for us. Let's pray together. Lord God, thank You for these great reminders this morning. What a great time it's been to look at Joseph's story and week after week see this marvelous display of Your sovereignty and Your providence. Help us not to forget that You also are still on Your throne today, that You are still active in our lives and the details of our lives and in the world around us. Give us hearts that can forgive, not because people deserve it, because we don't deserve it, but because You are a God who forgives, and we want to be like You and to forgive as You've forgiven us. We thank You for this in Christ's name.